A woman adjusts her child's blanket. The car is warm. The coal stove at the far end is throwing heat, and the kerosene lamp overhead rocks with the motion of the train. Outside the window, nothing. Snow driving sideways through the dark. 20 inches on the ground and still falling. Northern Ohio, the night of December 29th, 1876. The Pacific Express has been slow through the blizzard. 159 passengers and crew, most of them coming back from Christmas, pressed into the wooden coaches behind two steam locomotives. The heating stoves, kerosene, the rocking lamps, everything that makes the car feel safe is about to become the thing that kills them. The train reaches the Ashtabula River Bridge, 154 feet of iron, spanning a gorge 76 feet deep. The second locomotive crosses the far stone abutment, and the floor drops. 11 cars fall onto the frozen riverbed. The stoves burst through the walls. The kerosene ignites, and the passengers who survived the fall begin to burn. 92 people died that night. It was the worst railroad disaster of the 19th century. The engineer who had warned anyone who would listen that the bridge was going to fail was found dead in his bedroom 3 weeks later. A bullet in the back of his head. The death was ruled suicide. It took 123 years for someone to open the file that proved otherwise. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play. Two states this week, two stories where the evidence existed and the institutions whose job it was to act chose not to. Ohio and the Pacific Northwest. A railroad bridge and a river gorge. A murdered engineer and murdered miners. 10 years apart. 2,000 miles between them. Connected by the same failure. We start in Ohio, in the worst winter the state had seen in years. And a man named Charles Collins, who had been saying for years that the bridge was going to come down. Charles Collins was born October 31st, 1821, in Brunswick, New York, a small town northeast of Albany in the Hudson River Valley. He graduated from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, one of the first engineering schools in the country, at a time when an engineering degree meant something rare and consequential. He came to Cleveland in 1849, who helped build the Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati Railroad. Frontier work in an era when laying iron across Ohio was nation building. He rose fast. By the 1860s, Collins was the engineer in charge for the Lake Shore and Michigan Southern Railway, responsible for inspecting every bridge on the line. Those who knew him described a man who was competent, gentle, and well-liked in the communities he visited on inspection tours. He was not an indifferent railroad man who looked the other way. He was the man who looked directly at the problem and was told to keep walking. The problem was the Ashtabula Bridge. The design belonged to Amasa Stone, the railroad's president. Stone had built one other bridge like it, at a fraction of the scale. The design was an all-iron Howe truss, experimental, with no proven precedent at that length. Collins and fellow engineer Joseph Tomlinson both advised against it. Stone overruled them. It must have been a particular kind of dread standing at that bridge during inspection rounds, running his hands along the iron joints, knowing what he was looking at. He told colleagues a phrase that would outlast him. "This is no bridge of mine. This is the President's Bridge. He tried to resign. The board refused his resignation. He was still their engineer of record. His name on every inspection report when the bridge fell.
December the 29th, 1876. A blizzard pounding northern Ohio. The Pacific Express carrying 159 passengers crossed the Ashtabula Bridge at approximately 7:28 in the evening. The second locomotive reached the far stone abutment and the 150-foot span gave way. The catastrophe was over in seconds. A 76-foot fall into a frozen riverbed, then fire. Kerosene lamps and coal stoves igniting wooden coaches. Survivors trapped in the wreckage burning. Rescuers working by the light of the fire itself in the middle of a blizzard. Between 92 and 98 dead. 47 identified. 48 burnt so completely they never would be. Collins travelled to Ashtabula the morning after and wept at the scene. He returned to Cleveland and by early January tendered his resignation again. The board refused again. A coroner's jury convened on December the 31st. 68 days of testimony, more than 50 witnesses. The Ohio General Assembly created a special legislative committee. On January the 17th, 1877, Collins testified under oath before that committee. He told them the truth. The bridge was Stone's design. Stone's had overruled his objections. The structure was experimental and deficient. On January the 18th, 1877, the morning after his testimony, Charles Collins was found dead in the bedroom of his house on West 3rd Street in Cleveland, a single gunshot wound to the back of his head, ruled suicide. Collins' associate, Isaac C. Brewer, was among the first to see the death scene. He never believed it was suicide. His objections did not trigger a formal inquiry. The coroner's jury completed its work on March the 8th, 1877, nearly 7 weeks after Collins was already dead. They blamed five factors: poor design, undersized members, inadequate cross-bracing, deficient construction, and flammable heating systems. A mass of stone and the railroad were held responsible for the deaths of 92 people. No criminal charges followed. Not for the dead passengers, not for Collins. But 1 year later, 1878, two medical college professors conducted autopsies on Collins' exhumed body. Both reached the same conclusion: homicide. The evidence was in the angle of the bullet. Detectives who examined the trajectory, the position of the slug lodged in the wall near where Collins lay, determined that a self-inflicted wound was physically impossible at that angle. A gunshot to the back of the head at that trajectory could not have been fired by the victim's own hand. The historical events tells us who most likely killed Collins and why the system chose silence. The disaster killed between 92 and 98 people. Families destroyed in the Christmas week of 1876. Collins's name and face were in every newspaper. Stone was insulated by his wealth. Collins was findable. The prevailing theory, a relative of one of the dead, driven by grief, tracked Collins to his Cleveland home and shot him. The political calculation that followed was straightforward. Prosecuting a grieving family member for killing the man the public already blamed would have been deeply unpopular. Ruling it a suicide served everyone. Everyone except the truth. A second theory: railroad connected interests. Collins had directed blame at Stone and the corporate structure under oath. The suppression of two independent autopsy reports for over a century suggests organised concealment, not mere neglect. What is not in dispute? The physical evidence rules out suicide. Two independent medical examiners confirmed it. The Ohio legislature, meanwhile, declined to act on the reform bill drafted in the wake of the disaster. A bill that would have created the state's first bridge design code, required professional oversight, and mandated expert inspections. Corporate lobbying killed it. The federal government would not create meaningful railroad safety oversight until the Interstate Commerce Act of 1887, more than a decade later. Paper has a longer memory than institutions, and these autopsy reports were not destroyed, only hidden.
7 years after the disaster, in 1883, Amasa Stone, the man who designed the bridge, overruled two engineers and awarded the ironwork contract to his own brother's firm. Died by his own hand, he had lived those years under professional ruin and public scorn. No criminal charges had ever been brought against him. And then the case went quiet for a very long time. In 2001, a researcher working through historical paperwork from Cuyahoga County opened a box that had been sitting in archive storage for more than a century. Inside, two autopsy reports from 1878, both concluding homicide. The bullet trajectory, the physical impossibility of self-infliction, evidence that had been there all along. The revelation made local news. No investigation was reopened. Collins's killer remains unidentified. The case sits in Ohio's cold case files, 149 years unsolved. Charles Collins is buried in an elaborate mausoleum at Chestnut Grove Cemetery in Ashtabula County, a monument built by the community that knew him. He was 55 years old. He left behind a wife and family. He had tried to do the right thing, and the system he worked within first ignored him, then used him, and then erased the truth of how he died. The bridge fell apart because the powerful man who designed it could not be told he was wrong. The investigation ended because the dead engineer's murder was less convenient than his suicide. Charles Collins told the truth, and the truth did not save him. His autopsy reports were hidden for 123 years because the institutions that should have acted found his murder more convenient as a suicide. That is the question at the center of both stories tonight. Not whether evidence existed, it did in both cases, but whether the people who held that evidence wanted to act on it. In Ohio, a railroad company and a state government decided that an engineer's death was not worth pursuing. What happens when that same institutional indifference meets an entire group of people who, by federal law, have already been declared less than citizens? In 1882, 5 years before the next story, Congress passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, the only federal law in American history to ban a specific ethnic group from immigration. It stripped Chinese workers of citizenship, of legal standing, of the right to testify in court against white defendants. What happened next on the Snake River in 1887 was what that law made possible. Spring, 1887. The Snake River cuts through Hell's Canyon, the deepest gorge in North America, deeper than the Grand Canyon. Near the mouth of Deep Creek, on the Oregon side of the river, a group of Chinese miners have spent the winter working on the banks for flour gold. Months of patient physical labor, panning, sluicing, extracting fine flakes from the sediment. By spring, they had a cure. All right, real quick, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they figured out how to combine THC with functional ingredients, create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code Shane, S-H-A-N-E. They've found products for every vibe to help you sleep, get focused, feel happy and euphoric, even for better sex. I've been into their Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies, After a long week digging through case files, my brain does not want to shut off. I pop one of these about 15 minutes before bed, and it's like someone finally hits the off switch. No grogginess the next morning either. Beyond gummies, Mood also has flour, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Everything ships discreetly right to your door. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned earlier, listeners get 20% off their first order with Shane, S-H-A-N-E. So head to mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches what you're looking for, and don't forget to use promo code Shane at checkout to save 20% off your first order. Try it today at mood.com. Accumulated gold dust, worth an estimated $4,000 to $5,500. A man named Cheapu led the group. He and at least 9 others had come from Punya County, near Canton City, China. They had been in that canyon all winter. They did not know that a gang of horse thieves had moved into an abandoned cabin half a mile downstream and had been watching them. Now, I want to be honest about the geography here. This season pairs each episode with 2 states, and this episode carries the designation of Washington. The massacre happened in Willowa County, Oregon, on the Oregon side of the Snake River. But the story doesn't belong to a single state line. The miners departed from Lewiston, Idaho. The Snake River corridor runs through Idaho, Oregon, and Washington Territory. The deathbed confession that would eventually document what happened was published in Walla Walla, Washington. This is a story that belongs to the entire Pacific Northwest frontier. The 10 men whose names survive, Cheapu, Cheasun, Cheayao, Cheashun, Cheachong, Chialing, Chiachao, Chiachong, Kong Moon Kao, and Kong Gain, all from Punyu County near Canton City. What is now Guangzhou, Guangdong Province. 10 names out of a group that likely numbered 31 to 34. Southern China in the mid-19th century had been devastated by the Taiping Rebellion, one of the deadliest civil wars in human history. Millions dead, millions displaced. The promise of gold across the Pacific, Gomsong, Gold Mountain, pulled men from their families and sent them east. These men operated to the Sam Yup Company, one of the Chinese 6 companies headquartered in San Francisco, that organized labor, provided services, and tried, with limited success, to protect their members. The shared surname Chaya among the identified dead suggests most came from the same family network or village. A common pattern, men traveling together for safety and mutual support. By 1887, these miners existed in a legal void. The Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 made them ineligible for citizenship. Oregon's state constitution barred Chinese residents from owning property or mining claims. They could not vote. They could not testify in court against white defendants. Hell's Canyon was not only where the gold was, it was distance from the violence they had learned to expect in closer settlements. Cheapu's group set out from Lewiston, Idaho in October 1886. They couldn't know that the cliffs would narrow and the settlements would vanish as they traveled 65 miles upstream through the deepest river gorge in North America. Canyon walls rising hundreds of feet on both sides. They set up camp in tents and caves where Deep Creek meets the Snake River. This would be their home for 7 months. They couldn't know that Bruce Evans, known locally as Old Blue, had already noticed them.
Evans was a horse thief, married with two children, a known figure in Walloa County. His gang, J.T. Ty Canfield, Homer LaRue, Frank Vaughan, Ezekiel Hughes, Evans' brother-in-law Hiram Maynard, and Richard McMillan. McMillan was 15 years old, the blacksmith's son. They occupied an abandoned cabin half a mile downstream. They'd been watching the Chinese miners work. They knew about the gold. May the 27th, 1887, Canfield and LaRue positioned themselves on the bluffs above Deep Creek Cove, Evans and Vaughan concealed below in the path of anyone fleeing. High-powered rifles opened fire from the heights, driving the miners downward, directly into the guns of Evans and Vaughan. 12 killed in the initial attack. One man survived the gunfire. He was caught and beaten to death. The gang stripped the bodies, mutilated them, threw them into the Snake River, wrecked and burned the camp, stole the gold. The next day, May the 28th, 8 more miners arrived by boat. They did not know what had happened. The gang was still there. They shot all 8, bodies into the river. At least 10 confirmed dead by later identification. The evidence supports a total of 31 to 34 killed across both days. In early June 1887, Lee Shee's group travelled to Robinson Gulch to visit Chia Po's camp. They found 3 bodies in a ransacked, deserted site. The rest were gone, thrown into the river. They fled downstream and reported the murders to Lewiston, Idaho. Spring high water on the Snake meant bodies surfaced along the lower river for months. In February 1888, the Chinese government's diplomatic correspondence to the State Department formally identified 10 victims by name. Those 10 names, Chia Po through Kong Nang, were the only dead the system would count. The Chinese 6 companies in San Francisco mounted their own investigation. They offered a $1,000 reward, identified all 7 attackers, and pressured the United States government through diplomatic channels. The Chinese government's minister in Washington formally notified Secretary of State Thomas Bayard in February 1888. This was an act of state, China demanding accountability for its nationals. The American government's response was inadequate. Frank Vaughan confessed in March 1888 in exchange for immunity. His testimony before a grand jury on March the 23rd produced indictments against 6 others, Evans, Canfield, LaRue, McMillan, Hughes, and Maynard. 3 fled, Evans, Canfield, and LaRue, left the region and were never recaptured. Evans reportedly had community supporters in Walloa County who believed in his innocence despite the evidence. 3 faced trial, McMillan, 15, Hughes, 37, and Maynard, 38. The trial records tell us what happened in Enterprise, Oregon, on September 1, 1888. 2 days. The prosecution's case rested on Vaughan's testimony. The defence questioned identifications and played to the racial sympathies of the jury. An all-white jury, in a county where Chinese residents could not testify, could not vote, could not own property, deliberated briefly.
Not guilty, on all counts.
A witness who attended the trial later acknowledged the obvious. The jury had no interest in convicting white men for the deaths of Chinese miners. Robert McMillan, the boy who was 15 at the time of the massacre, died young. Before he died, he told his father the full story. In 1891, Hugh McMillan published his son's account in The Statesman, a Walla Walla, Washington newspaper. The confession is the most detailed account that exists. The 2-day ambush, the division of roles, those on the bluffs and those below, the beating of the last survivor, the disposal of the bodies, the theft of $5,500 in gold dust. It confirmed everything. It changed nothing. The legal case was closed. The confession was published and ignored. The trial documents went into a county safe, and the canyon kept its silence. But in 1995, someone in Walloa County would open that safe.
Charlotte MacGyver, the Walloa County clerk, was emptying an old safe to donate to the Walla County Museum. She opened it and found a cache of documents inside: grand jury indictments, depositions, notes from the 1888 trial. It had been sitting in that safe, either deliberately hidden or simply forgotten, for more than a century. A safe that nobody had opened. Evidence that nobody had looked for. The find prompted renewed investigation. R. Gregory Noakes, a veteran journalist and former reporter from the Oregonian, spent years researching the massacre and published Massacred for Gold, The Chinese in Hell's Canyon, in 2009, through Oregon State University Press, bringing their story to wide public attention for the first time since 1887. In 2005, the United States Board on Geographic Names officially designated the massacre site as Chinese Massacre Cove over the objections of Willowa County commissioners. On June 22, 2012, a granite memorial was installed at the site, engraved in three languages, English, Nez Perce, and Chinese. The inscription reads, Chinese Massacre Cove, site of the 1887 massacre of as many as 34 Chinese gold miners. No one was held accountable. Those last five words, no one was held accountable. Of the 31 to 34 men who went into that canyon and never came out, only 10 have names in the historical record. The remaining 20 or more, no family traced, no monument inscription, no official count even agreed upon. They were thrown into the Snake River, carried downstream, and the record went silent. Not because the evidence was missing, because the system that held the evidence chose not to act on it. Two cases, two states, Ohio and the Pacific Northwest, 1877 and 1887, 10 years and 2,000 miles apart. In Ashtabula, Charles Collins was a trained engineer, a man with credentials and standing, and his murder was buried because it was politically inconvenient for a railroad company that had already killed 92 people and faced no consequences. His autopsy reports sat in a county archive for 123 years. At Deep Creek, Chiapo, and at least nine others from Puna County, possibly more than 30, were shot from the bluffs above their camp by horse thieves who wanted their gold. The killers were identified, confessed to, indicted, tried, and acquitted. The trial documents set in a county safe for more than a century. The evidence existed in both cases, not circumstantial, not ambiguous. Autopsy reports, a sworn confession, grand jury indictments. And in both cases, the institutions that held that evidence chose not to act. This is the story America tells itself as it approaches 250 years, that justice is foundational, but the law protects equally. These two cases, from the same decade, from the Gilded Age that built the country's railroads and extracted its gold, ask a different question. Not whether justice was possible, but whether the people in power wanted it. And the answer, in Ohio and in Oregon, was the same. The engineer who told the truth in Ohio, the miners who crossed an ocean and worked a winter in the deepest gorge in North America. Their evidence is in the record. It always was. Until next time, good night, friend.